From Storyflow, this is your daily audio brief. It's Chloe, August 7th. 10 stories, evidence-led, no fluff, small inputs compound. Let's get into it. First, from Good Mood Food. What I meal prepped this week for us and our one-year-old. I'm glad you asked. This week's post is a straightforward mom-to-mom share of what Karina prepped for herself and her one-year-old. She's not presenting research, just a practical batch cook routine that anyone can copy if they need quick, kid-friendly meals. She walked through three main dishes: pecorino zucchini pancakes, grated zucchini squeezed dry, mixed with cheese, eggs, flour, and a pinch of onion salt, then pan-fried. Lemon dill chicken meatballs, ground chicken, eggs, breadcrumbs, lemon zest, garlic, dill, and parsley baked at 400 degrees for about 20 minutes, and a creamy carrot cake inspired buckwheat porridge, a sweet stovetop breakfast she paired with mascarpone for extra richness. She notes that you can double the salt for adult-only meals and swap pecorino for parmesan if you prefer a milder flavour. Beyond the recipes, Karina mentions a short-term 30-minute budget meal series she's running for paid subscribers. But the core takeaway is simple: a handful of versatile, nutrient-dense dishes that keep both a toddler and a busy parent fed without spending hours in the kitchen. Next, second, from Flavours by Ale, Italian-style Sloppy Joe. It's a twist on the classic, with sausage and a bunch of flavour. Apparently, the person who wrote about it didn't really grow up with Sloppy Joes as a staple. They're more of an Italian-American household kind of food. They remembered hearing about them at school and asking their mum to make them, but they were just okay. The recipe itself sounds pretty good, with garlic-buttered brioche and melty mozzarella. I'm curious to know more about how they put their own spin on the classic Sloppy Joe. It seems like the writer is trying to elevate the traditional Sloppy Joe, which can be a bit bland. By adding Italian sausage and other bold flavours, they're giving it a bit of a makeover. I think it's interesting that they're drawing from their own experiences and cultural background to create something new. The combination of flavours and ingredients sounds like it could be a winner. The use of garlic-buttered brioche and mozzarella cheese adds a richness to the dish that might take it to the next level. I'm not sure if I'd try making it myself, but it's definitely an intriguing idea. Up next, third, from Healing the Source. 15 health lessons I've stopped negotiating on. I've stopped arguing with myself because the evidence keeps pointing to the same basics. No single diet that cuts out whole food groups, whether all plants or all animals, has solid proof of being optimal. What works long-term is simply eating a mix that gives you nutrients from both sides, without getting caught up in the tribe talk of diet wars. The quality of what you put on the plate matters as much as the calories. Ultra-processed foods blunt your natural fullness cues, so you tend to overeat, whereas whole, minimally processed foods keep you satisfied at the same calorie level. Protein still matters, but it's not a magic bullet. Aim for enough to support muscle and overall health, then let the rest of your diet be balanced, varied, and enjoyable. These three pillars, balance over extremes, food quality over sheer calorie count, and sensible protein, are the core of the 15 lessons I now stick to without negotiation. And then, fourth, from Lindsay Mack's Complexity Edge, the autism question. We're not asking, what if it's OCPD? So there's this idea that people with autism or ADHD might also have obsessive compulsive personality disorder, or OCPD. It's not necessarily a new concept, but it's something that's not always considered, especially when it comes to adults. The author is saying that sometimes people might get diagnosed with autism or ADHD because those labels fit their symptoms, but they might actually be dealing with OCPD, which is a different condition altogether. The key difference is that OCPD is more about control and perfectionism, often stemming from a need to avoid making mistakes or disappointing others. It's not just about sensory issues or routine, but about an internal moral code that can be incredibly exhausting. The author is arguing that we need to be more precise in our diagnoses, because getting the right label can make all the difference in terms of getting the right kind of support. In fact, the author suggests that sometimes what looks like autistic rigidity might actually be OCPD. It's a subtle distinction, but an important one. The author is not saying that autism identification is bad or that people shouldn't get diagnosed, but rather that we need to be more careful and nuanced in our assessments. This is especially important for adults who might have been diagnosed with autism or ADHD as children, but are now realizing that their symptoms might be related to something else entirely. Next. Fifth, from Off-Grid with Marjorie Wildcraft, Dancing Through Life. So I was listening to this podcast and the host, Marjorie Wildcraft, was talking about navigating tough times. She didn't really share any specific research or data, but more of her personal thoughts and observations. It was pretty casual and conversational, like a chat with a friend. She did mention learning how to grow your own food, which I think is a really useful skill, especially for people who might be new to it or have limitations like being older or out of shape. The idea is that even small steps can be helpful, and it's not about being an expert, but just about taking care of yourself and being more self-sufficient. The podcast itself is called The Grow Network, and it seems to focus on sharing tips and insights on growing your own food and being more resilient. Marjorie's approach is pretty down-to-earth and encouraging, which is nice. She's not trying to scare people or make them feel overwhelmed, but rather just offering some helpful advice and support. Overall, it was a pretty low-key and uplifting conversation, and I think it could be helpful for people who are looking for some practical tips and reassurance during difficult times. Up next, sixth, from Tell Me Three Good Things. 6 August 2026. Three good things. It's a simple reminder. You don't need a vacation, a good mood, or even gratitude to notice, name, and share the good things around you. On hard or dark days, just pause and point out the basics. A roof over your head, fresh air, a warm pillow, sunshine on your face. Even tiny pleasures like a bite of chocolate or a cup of tea count. If you're stuck, reach out, email, comment, or just share with the community. Someone will wrap you in a little love and help you spot those moments. And remember, the act of naming them is enough. Keep going and tell me three good things you've noticed. And then, seventh, from Vinay Prasad's observations and thoughts, former COVID czar says lab leak, and who is responsible for decisions, politicians or scientists? A new study on the origins of COVID-19 has some interesting implications. The research, which looked at 54 different coronaviruses, found that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is most closely related to a bat coronavirus from the same region where the first cases were reported in Wuhan, China. This suggests that a lab leak is less likely, but not impossible. The study's findings are based on a large dataset of coronaviruses, which is a strength of the research. However, it's worth noting that the study is observational, meaning it can't prove causation. The researchers also didn't have direct access to the Wuhan lab, which is a limitation. The study's lead author says that the data suggests a natural origin for the virus, but that a lab leak can't be ruled out entirely. This is a nuanced view, and it's consistent with what we know so far about the pandemic. The debate over the origins of COVID-19 is complex, and it's not just about the science. It's also about who's responsible for the decisions that were made during the pandemic. The former COVID czar says that politicians and scientists need to be held accountable for their decisions, and that we need to learn from the mistakes that were made. The study's findings are a reminder that the origins of COVID-19 are still not fully understood, and that we need to be cautious when making conclusions. Next. 8th, from the Vagenda. Menopause is hot. What Google Trends can tell us. Women are increasingly searching for menopause information online, which is a positive development given the topic's history of being under-discussed and underfunded. A survey found that 90% of women in perimenopause hadn't been taught about menopause in school, and only 2.1% reported being very informed. Most women start looking for information when symptoms begin or shortly thereafter. The rise of menopause influencers has helped destigmatize the topic, but there's also been a shift from information to misinformation and product promotion. Researchers tracked menopause-related Google trends from 2005 to 2025 in the US, UK, and Australia, finding that commercial searches increased from 15-20% to 33% of total searches between 2010 and 2025. The highest volume commercial searches were related to supplements, with black cohosh being the most common, despite a lack of convincing evidence for its effectiveness and potential liver toxicity. Digital services, particularly apps, were also highly searched. The study's findings suggest that the commercialization of menopause is increasing, with more people looking for products and services rather than information. This trend is concerning, as it may lead to the spread of misinformation and the promotion of unproven or potentially harmful products. That's the read. Small inputs, compounding results. Back tomorrow. New here? Grab your own free feed at storyphalo.com. It only takes a few seconds.